Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
I am your host, Brett King. We are live from windy New York. It's, you know, normally you talk about Chicago being the windy city, but it is crazy windy today in New York. We've got a couple of guests coming up to talk about their new book, The Truth Machine, Paul and Michael. So we're going to be with them shortly. But before that, we have our good friend Dave Birch joining to co-host today. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Brett. Great to be here.
Yeah, so you're not in working today. You're actually in Jersey, right?
That's right. I'm in Jersey, which has been sunny and lovely today. It's been great.
So for those you know, who are listening on the AM band in New York, where is Jersey?
It's near France. And for bizarre historical reasons, it's sort of but not actually part of the UK.
Right. So it is a UK territory, so
It's a bailiwick, which is an even more complicated. It's something to do with Henry VIII. Don't worry about it. But it's not part of France, and strictly speaking, it's not part of the UK.
Okay, but it's somewhere in between. So is it an island in between the mainland?
Yeah, there's Jersey, Guernsey, Sark. They're all islands that somehow got traded by Henry VIII for something or other. I can't remember exactly.
And what is Jersey famous for?
Financial services and dairy products.
There you go.
So about half the GDP is financial services. And as a consequence, developments in the sort of fintech space are, you know, pretty important to the economy here. So that's why I'm down here.
Do you know roughly the population of Jersey?
Not very big. I mean, it's like, I don't know, 100,000 or something. I'd have to go and look it up. But it's small. It's small.
There you go.
But there are others.
It's always interesting going to an island like that. You know, whenever I used to go down to Flinders Island or King Island in between, you know, Tasmania and Melbourne when I lived there, it's a very different mentality. All the foreigners, all people come visit. You're a mainlander. You're from the mainland. Anyway. So listen, let's just jump into this. We've got a few news items. Dave, feel free to jump in where applicable.
Sure.
You know, the big news today, of course, is BCG, Boston Consulting Group, has said we have reached the top of VC investment in fintech. They expect that equity VC investment in fintech will decline up to 50% this year, saying that last year they think that hit its peak. Now, last year, of course, we had $5 billion in investment come through ICO tokens. So maybe that's part of the shift there. We'll see structurally whether or not there's a big shift. Of course, Asia and Europe are still to some extent catching up in terms of pure investment dollars to the US. So potentially there's still some way to go globally for fintech investment before we reach a point where it's in big decline. So I'm not sure BCG, they might have called this a little bit early. I think it might trail off, but not drop off. Facebook has said they're going to adopt the GDPR rules globally. What does GDPR stand for, Dave? Do you remember?
It's General Data Protection Regulation.
So this regulation emerged out of the European Union, of course, for work in for data protection in the European Union, with Facebook's adoption of this for their organization globally as a guideline. It could be interesting to see if GDPR-type data privacy rules become a global thing.
You've got it the wrong way around. So Facebook have said they're going to apply it for Europe, but they have to because it's the law. But they're not yet going to apply it globally, whereas Google, I think, said they're going to apply it globally.
It's because I think the news today is that they're going to apply it globally.
No, wait a minute. It's the other way around, isn't it?
Yeah.
They are going to apply it.
Yeah, so I just saw the news that they're going to do it globally. I just saw that came out today. So.
Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah.
The numbers, the Financial Times reckons that European companies are going to spend €8 billion on GDPR this year.
Well, it's been
a
long time coming.
It's a full employment act for lawyers.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's going to do any good, who can say?
Again, in the regulation, Monetary Authority of Singapore, MAS, our favourite fintech regulator, maybe apart from London City, MAS has said they're going to put in place ethical guidelines for the use of artificial intelligence. So this is not just a fintech or finance problem. Obviously, artificial intelligence and ethical use of AI is sort of a global problem. I'm unsure why we haven't seen regulators start thinking about this already more than what we're seeing with like the MAS initiative here. But it's probably because regulators only act when there's risk to the market. And while AI is perceived as a potential risk, the risks to the actual market are fairly limited right now, so we'll see. But ethical guidelines and codifying ethics.
The thing is, Brett, that you know we shouldn't really think of AI as a fintech. I think you know we should see AI as more of a regtech. I mean, AI is a way of making markets. When you combine it with the transparency of the blockchain, which we're going to be talking about shortly, AI is a way to make markets work better. I think we should be very enthusiastic about the ability of AI to improve financial markets.
All right. Well, so this is it's interesting. The one other thing that I saw in the news that I think could be interesting is Russia has come out and said that they are looking at putting in place a East Asia. This is obviously continental East Asia and Eurozone payments network built on Mastercoin, the Ethereum blockchain tech. So Russia's essentially calling for an Ethereum Asia-wide, European-wide payments network. Be quite interesting if a government gets behind an Ethereum-based payments architecture. If Russia and China were to do this together, for example, it could be very, very interesting. All right. So, coming up in conferences, you wanted to talk about something in respect to conferences, Dave, in a moment, but let me just get through a few of these conference announcements we have. The Flourish Branded Currency Conference in Chicago, April 9 to 11. JP is going to be there keynoting. Jason Hendricks from Provoke is going to be hosting a fireside chat. Provoke listeners get a 20% discount when they register with Provoke20 at flourishcon.com. And we'll be, we heard from the founders of Flourish in the segment last week. The Mobile Payments Conference is open. Early bird registration is open until April 30th. Provoke listeners save $200 when they register at mobilepaymentsconference.com using the code MPC18FIN. So, Jason and I had a blast doing a live episode of Breaking Banks there with them last year. So it'd be good to see that event again this year. April 25th, I'll be speaking in Beijing for Huawei, April 27th in Berlin for the Deutsche Bank Asset Management Conference there. So keep a watch out for where you see Provoke hosts at events. Dave, what's your you got a conference? You got conferences lined up in the next couple of weeks or couple of months?
Yeah, I'm going to ETA Transact in Las Vegas in a couple of weeks' time, which I'm really looking forward to. What's going on in the retail merchant payment space, and I'm going to be chairing the panel about blockchains and cryptocurrencies at that. I'm also the 2020 Europe in Amsterdam, which we're all looking forward to at the beginning of June.
Where is it in this year? Where's Money 2020 Europe this year?
It's going to be in Amsterdam this year.
Okay,
it got too big for Copenhagen, right. So I'm going to be chairing the artificial intelligence panel, which I'm very much looking forward to, and I'll also be running the digital identity deep dives on day three. So, and also I just wanted to mention, I don't know if many people listening went to it, but Money 2020 in Asia a couple of weeks ago was great. Really, really enjoyed that. Very different from the European and
what do you think made a difference?
Asian and Chinese influence. Well, you know this, I mean, perhaps you're more familiar with it than I am, but seeing the Chinese and Asian perspectives on a lot of these things, that was just great. I mean, it was really eye-opening, the scale of some of the stuff that's going on over there. So I just wanted to say that's given me a few new ideas as well.
Yeah. Now, we're getting a little bit of wireless internet problems with you, Dave, but we will persist.
Sorry, I'm on hotel Wi-Fi as well. Yeah.
No, I get it. No problem. And there was there's an interesting story about Floyd Mayweather. What was that one?
I love that story. So, let's just be clear. Not everybody doing an ICO is a crook and going to go to jail, right? I mean, A lot of them are, but not everybody. But this particular one just caught my attention.
Floyd Mayweather,
had somehow got in. Yeah, like the boxer.
Yeah, the boxer.
And he got involved in promoting this ICO. The guys that run the ICO have just been arrested by the SEC, and they're going to go to jail. I mean, I really hope they don't put them in the same school. It's very unpleasant.
But, well, he promoted it. I don't know if he was intimately involved in it, right? So this was Centratech. The co-founders, Robert Farkas and Sora Sharma, alleged and masterminded a fraudulent ICO in which Centra offered and sold unregistered investments through a CTR token. So that's the SEC notice on that.
But wasn't there a big spate of like celebrities somehow getting wangled into promoting these ICOs? That looks like it might have been a little unwise.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, let's get to the main reason for the show today. We have a couple of guests back on the show, Michael J. Casey and Paul Venya. Is that how I pronounce it, Paul?
Yeah, that's it. You nailed it. Very, very on the first shot. Very
absolutely
impressed.
So the authors of a great new book. It's on fire with a bullet on the Amazon bestsellers list right now. It's called The Truth Machine, The Blockchain, and the Future of Everything. If you are keeping notes, what I liked seeing about this is I went to Financial Engineering, the Amazon bestsellers in Financial Engineering, and The Truth Machine, is number one, number two, and number three on the top 10 bestsellers list in Amazon right now.
I can never work out those categories, though. Like Financial Engineering, there's computing, cryptography, I think, is another one we've been in the top of.
And security and encryption.
Security and encryption, yeah, things like that. It's never about like what I think the book's actually about.
Yeah, well, number one, two, and 11 on the cryptography bestsellers list on Amazon today. So that's because of your three different editions. You got the hardcover, the Kindle, and the Audible.
Right. Version. Right, yeah, that
so you helps, the triple absolutely. Shell. So, but that's fantastic news, guys. So congrats on having another bestseller. Paul, of course, you are a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. You cover Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency for Wall Street. Michael, some of you guys know, we've had him on the show numerous times. He's done a lot of blockchain and Bitcoin stuff for us early in the piece. He now runs the MIT Currency Initiative out there at the MIT.
To be clarified, I don't run it, but just be clear, I'm an advisor there, but nonetheless,
And you're also the chair of the advisory board for CoinDesk, am I correct?
That's correct.
Very cool. So great to have you guys back on the show. So first of all, is this a sequel to your last book that you guys did together, or is this an entirely new book? Where does it fit in the anthology?
You want to grab that, Paul?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would say it's a follow-on more than a sequel. Again, I mean, we're talking about nonfiction books. These aren't really narratives. This isn't, Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or something like that. So you could read these, you could read the two books separately, and, you don't need to read the first one because it's not a sequel. Truth Machine is not a sequel to The Age of Cryptocurrency. Right. It's just kind of a follow-on. It's really sort of just a deeper look at this whole field. And when we wrote the first book, in 2015, it was all kind of about Bitcoin and our own exploration of it. We had just kind of within the last year or so had gotten involved in this. And so a lot of the book is, wow, what is this? Let's figure this out. So we kind of go through it in that sense. And that's us doing it as well as we're writing it. And then at the end of the book, there's a chapter talking about what at the time they were calling Bitcoin 2.0. And it was just kind of a, hey, look, there's other things you can do besides currency with this technology. That chapter is really what this whole book is about.
Right. So it's the entire potential scope of blockchain in terms of what it could do to change the world, I guess, right?
Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
And I would add, so one thing, when we first started to write it, I think we felt like it would just be more, in fact, we had planned a shorter book. It was just going to be something of, of an accounting, a survey, if you like, of the various use cases. And then Blockchain Revolution came out, the Tapscott book, and that's kind of filled that space. And so But at the same time, we were realizing that there was actually a much deeper story to tell. And it wasn't just saying you could do this, this, and that. But I think that what a lot of us, and I think, Dave, you've been down this path, others, you know, exploring what exactly it means. What do we mean by trust? What is the role of trustlessness, if that's even possible? These broader questions about the structure of what a permission versus a permissionless blockchain. There's a lot of really interesting philosophical and important sort of structural design questions that we realized had to be dealt with. And so we sort of, I think, you know, ended up writing a deeper, more comprehensive book about, you know, what exactly this is. Why does this whole new system of record keeping matter in the first place? And what are the opportunities, but also challenges that it presents us?
So can you guys sort of tell me a bit more about what's behind the name? Why you call it the Truth Machine? How does that
I already
describe?
Had a fight with them about calling
you
it the
did,
Truth
David,
Machine.
You did, David. They have.
We've been there, Brett.
We haven't been there on the air. That's the point.
Yeah. I'll grab it because I think it was interesting when I first put my tweet out saying, you know, now available or whatever, one guy came back and said, worst title ever. And I was actually, okay, cool, good.
Was that you, Birch?
I probably said I probably said something else. I don't know.
Careful, dude. We're on the AM band. Careful. I know what you're saying.
I would
have
been so charitable. But we've resolved our differences over that. So
we have. I hopefully
understand it.
Let me explain it because I think it's important. Because I think that it actually gets to what do we mean by truth, which sounds like I'm like, okay, oh God, now we're going to get into some weird philosophical discussion. But the point is actually really relevant. People assume that we're talking about a machine that will help us arrive at an absolute truth, the sort of like the finality of what really truly is true. And no, the blockchain will not answer the mysteries of the universe. It will not tell you, you know, exactly what color something is. And it certainly does allow people to lie. You can put lies into a blockchain, and they will become entrenched in an immutable way. And that's something that obviously we
Rumors recently that the Bitcoin blockchain had child porn embedded in it.
That's not a rumor. That's actually true.
Yes, it is. But it's also, to be very clear, that doesn't mean that you can find an image sitting on the blockchain. I mean, that was a really, there's a lot of hysteria around that, which I think was really unreasonable, certainly to the extent to which people thought that should prompt certain regulation. But there's a good coin centerpiece on what to understand about what that means and what that, that's, but that's off track a little bit. I want to get to what we mean by truth, right? I think there's an actually far more useful notion of truth that is an integral part of how society goes about forming relationships and economic exchange. So you guys probably know the work of Yuval Harari, the wonderful Israeli political scientist, in his book, Sapiens. And he talks about how human beings tell stories. And we tell stories so that we can agree on a consensus of facts. And it actually doesn't always matter whether those facts are true or not. Is religion true? I don't know. But religion actually has this profoundly important organizational capacity.
And there is consensus within the religious groups.
And there's consensus around, right? Same as there is consensus around what money is. And Dave can sort of talk to you at length about theories of money, but money is this kind of a collective understanding of a notion, and we come up with these ridiculous notions that we think a piece of paper actually has intrinsic value, and of course it's a token, right? So, but all of that's really, really, really valuable. This consensus of facts is valuable. What we're saying is that that's the truth we're interested in, this notion of a shared concept of truth, how we arrive at that consensus. And why we're saying it's a machine is because previously that shared notion was basically brought down from on high by a centralized institution that says, this is the truth, accept it. And we accept it and move with it. Now we're saying, well, that's always been flawed. There's actually a lot of problems with, you know, numbers being controlled by these trusted third parties. Here's a consensus mechanism. Here's a way for us to actually arrive at that shared truth. Well, whether it is actually fundamentally absolutely true or not, this shared notion of the truth is what we can now arrive at.
We were discussing it originally, Michael, that's why the consensus machine, I think, is a much better title. But I mean, I understand the realities of what publishers want.
Exactly.
But consensus is a difficult word.
And what authors want, too. I would not want the consensus machine to be the title of my book. I like the truth machine.
I like it too. I like it. It's a very it's
but it's not true.
But now, what is true? Oh, no. I mean, but you know, like, okay. What is, you know, what is absolute truth? Find it objectively in the world. Absolute truth. No, no, no. There's no such thing as absolute truth. Truth is a concept that we make up. It is. All of it is.
And your truth can be different from other people's truth. Yeah.
Right. So the point is that this is a program, a machine, a protocol, a product, whatever you want to call it, that allows us to get closer to a goal of objective truth than any other one that we've had before. That's the whole point of it. Well, and I think it has great potential to do that.
So, Paul, let me ask you, in respect to that mechanism, one of the big things that particularly, you know, the crypto community in terms of cryptocurrencies are, you know, very keen on emphasizing is the decentralized nature of, you know, the blockchain and so forth. So in the scheme of things, how important a shift do you think the blockchain is in respect to decentralizing information?
Well, I think it's a huge shift, assuming that, you know, it's very interesting to me is that one of the kind of core frictions of this entire movement is this whole thing about centralized versus decentralized systems. We haven't really used decentralized systems on a large basis, not, you know, certainly not historically. In the last 20 years since the internet came around, it's gotten more usage. But I mean, I think the potential, and what's interesting about Bitcoin, when you look at Bitcoin itself, the program, and you look at the features and the way Nakamoto put everything together, it's a pretty elegant program. I know people now, kind of, you know, a lot of real hardcore techies will say it's clunky, it's slow, blah, blah, blah. But it really does allow you to do things that you were not able to do before. And one of those is to have this decentralized network where everybody is working, everyone's contributing to it, and you have miners contributing computing power, and you have a lot of people agreeing upon a certain set of facts, transactions, the ledger history.
Right.
I think that's a pretty fascinating project and a pretty fascinating experiment. And everything that we're going to talk about kind of stems from that. I think the idea of decentralization can be really powerful if we get it right.
Now, the other element of this is solving some of the big problems, things like making sure everybody has access to services and capabilities that, you know, are available, say, on the internet of the future. So whether you've got a handset or whether you've got a computer or a tablet, the fact that you can be able to conduct commerce and be involved in the world of the future that runs on data. So for problems like identity and financial inclusion, talk to me about how you guys tackled that in the book, how blockchain, you know, contributes to that. Michael?
I'd like to frame it like this as well. I think we are, one aspect of this is security, and security is a lens through which to think about it, cybersecurity. My view is that we have a serious clash underway between this sort of relentless decentralization of the kind of structure of our economy and the sort of relentless centralization of control of the data. So, you know, the Internet of Things, the, you know, peer-to-peer lending, you know, distributed energy systems, you know, Uber, ride-sharing, all of these things are a sort of decentralizing force to some extent, right? The sharing economy, all these things are pushing us constantly to the edges. And Brett, you talk a lot about this in your work around augmented and things like that, right? Yep. But it's happening at the exact same time that the data around all of those interactions and the data economy is a very, very real thing. We now know more than ever, right? That data economy, the most valuable currency we have is actually data, is being controlled by these sort of centralized, powerful behemoths.
So and that's actually a recipe. Banks, you know, DMV departments.
Google's the large, you know, but also, you know, it's these big new internet players, right? The data aggregators. Google, Amazon, they're in the business of aggregating, packaging, repackaging, selling data. That's a lot of what they do, and maximizing profit based on the control of that. And that is problematic from a security perspective as much as, and as well as from an access point of view. So if we're thinking about a sharing economy, so let's break those two things down. The first is security. You've got hackers who now have the best of both worlds, because you've got, on the one hand, easy access points, all these, you know, doorknobs and whatever else, they're going to be somehow interconnected nobody's putting patches on them every time they need a security update, right? Every little access point around the world is now going to be an entry point into these ever-growing honeypots of very wealthy, very valuable data. It's just no wonder we are seeing an exponential kind of increase in the amount of cybercrime. It's just these two forces at work. So we need to think about what sort of trust architecture we create. What is the new paradigm for how we manage this particular thing? And the current system's broken. So I think that whether it's a blockchain, yeah.
In a world where, you know, we have all these accusations of fake news and, bad actors getting involved in trying to turn elections and so forth, how is a blockchain going to enable us to trust organizations?
So the first thing I like to say is, like, I don't know that blockchain as we currently define it and know it is the answer. But one of the very strong points in this book is that this is not a static technology. There is an enormous amount of development going. And what the blockchain of the future, even if that's going to be the right word, I actually seriously doubt it, looks like will probably be quite different from what it is now. What we do know is that the decentralized construct, the idea of reaching consensus through these decentralized mechanisms, so that we can have a new disintermediated trust architecture, is the solution to this. And so what it really does, I think, is it breaks down the economic model. It means that the only way to manage our relationships with each other is to have these behemoths stand in the middle, and they get all these economies of scale that come from being the network effects that come from what they own, the fact that they are able to afford to pay for, whether it's the big data farms and all these things that allow them to build these big silos of control. Whereas if we can push out control of data to the edges and therefore make it possible for new business models to emerge that don't rely upon this sort of economies of scale in the center of these large data aggregators, then we actually have an economic model that breaks them down. Now, you'll get new centralizing forces. You always do. That's what capitalism does. The efficiencies will come from that. But the point is, it's going to be hopefully much harder to establish those big systems because there's new workarounds that people can do. And in some respects, that's what the internet has already done, right? I mean, we saw how outsourcing and sort of the globalization of supply chains and so forth disrupted these existing, brick and mortar models that were very controlled in the developed world. I think the same thing is going to happen around the data economy, and that's what's most interesting about it, is that the business models will be challenged, and because you just don't need them in the same way that we did before.
So with all this data flowing around the planet and more connectivity between, traditionally intermediated businesses, but now they can sort of be connected directly, and you have all of these new combinations of platforms and services that are arising because the internet's sort of gluing together all of these different types of services, and then you've got tech like blockchain involved. As we start to remove those intermediaries and you just have this evolution of sort of pure commerce or AIs working together, for example, how do you then get a consensus where you know you can trust a player that's involved in a transaction?
I don't know.
All right.
Well, I mean, Brett, you call yourself a futurist. I try to avoid that phrase.
I think the answer, Brett, is I apologize. I don't have the book in front of me right now, but there was a section in the book that was called something like redefining identity. Right, guys?
Yes.
And you mentioned in passing. You only mention it in passing, but it caught my attention, where you say something about that using the blockchain to store proofs about things mm-hmm. rather than the things themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's got the seeds of the solution in it.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you would have this record of consensus about proofs, that's a very different way of looking at the world. And I think that's a very fruitful line of thinking. You don't store data about me, you store proofs of some of the data. You store the proof that I'm over 18, not the fact that I'm over 18, and this is a very, very powerful. When you alluded to the fact that you have this new family of technologies,
things like this are very powerful members of that family, which we really only touch on at the moment. So yeah, I think actually the book, I think the book does contain the seeds of a solution.
I think it does too, which is why I gave you the...
Thanks, guys. I'm glad that you had the first
one. All right, so listen, guys, let's just have a quick break, and then we'll come back and we've got Bill Barthart joining us from ABRA as well. But before we do that, don't forget that this is a show that enables participation. If you want to get in and you have a question for Michael or Paul, we are live. You can give us a question via Twitter. Use the handle at BreakingBanks1 or at Brett King or at DGW Birch. You guys can send us a question if you've got a question for either Michael or Paul or Bill coming up next. But we're going to take a quick break right now. We'll be back right after these words from our sponsors.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King, and I have joining me as co-host this week the inimitable Mr. David Birch, joining us from Jersey. Do they have jerseys in Jersey?
They have nothing but. They're all over the place.
There you go. All right. So before the break, we were talking to Michael J. Casey and Paul Vigna. Michael, I have to ask, why is it Michael J.?
Oh, because there are just a million Michael Caseys in the world. There's a Michael Casey who's a magician. There's a Michael Casey. I just a few minutes ago had to email.
Oh, well, that's not you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a magician of a different type. But there's this Irish Michael Casey who's a bird watcher. I'm constantly getting emails with pictures of, like, you know, seagulls and things in them from his friends. I'm like, it's not me, but I just got sent an email saying, are you ready for your trip to Bournemouth? And I was like, no, I am definitely not ready for a trip. So I forwarded it to my namesake.
I'm at a magic conference that week.
Right. This is a different one. I've written a blog piece about, like, you know, the confusion. When you're an author,
Did we lose him? Yeah, we lost him. We lost Michael.
Did we totally lose him?
I don't know. No, he's still on, but he's...
There he is.
Here he is back. Yeah, we lost you for a second there, Michael.
There's a Michael B. Casey who's an excellent... who's a crypto strategist. There's, you know, it's ridiculous. Trust me.
Yeah, so differentiation. You could just change your name to the Truth Machine.
That's not bad. Yeah, I like it.
Like out of, what is it, Jersey Shore, the situation, that's the guy's name, or friend. You could be, I'm the Truth Machine.
He's Michael.
Oh my God. That's it. That's done. You're done. That's it. That's your name now.
Yeah.
That is solid.
No.
He's Michael Consensus Casey to me.
All right. So guys, you know, just give us a little bit more on, you know, how the book is doing, where people can get the book. You know, we'll redo this at the end of the show, but you know, where can I pick up The Truth Machine?
You know, certainly Amazon, Barnes and Noble, online. Yeah, I mean, anywhere where, you know, only the finest books are sold. Of course, it'll be there. Including Amazon, which sells 8 million of the finest books. So it's on Amazon. It's in the bookstores. So you can get it pretty much anywhere.
It is.
It's doing very well. It's actually doing really well. We're pretty happy with it. Yeah.
There is the hard copy version available. There is the Kindle version available. And there is an Audible version as well. So we have the audiobook. And there will be a paperback edition out in a year. But I shouldn't be telling people that now because it's...
You want the hard cover. It's going to be special. It's going to be special for many years.
Yes. And Paul, how are things going over at WSJ?
They're going well. I mean, they're okay. You know, look, obviously the whole industry is under some pressure, but we're doing okay selling business news, and I'm doing great being the blockchain reporter. It's kind of fun to be that. We've never had one who's been who's had this as a beat. So that's kind of been a new thing for all of us. But it's been good. It's been great for me. I'm lucky and I'm in a pretty good position. So things are going well.
Fantastic. Well, it's good to have you guys on the show. Stick around, and we got Bill coming up now, and you guys can join the conversation. So joining us back on the show is the founder of Abra. I'll let him describe Abra in a moment, but Bill Barhart, is that how I pronounce it, Bill?
Barhart, like the height Barhart. Of the bar.
Barhart, okay. Yeah. So last time Bill spoke to us, he was sitting in an airport boarding lounge, so we could hear the boarding announcements come in, but this time he tells me he's not at the airport. But Bill, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thrilled to be here. I've been enjoying the conversation.
Yeah, now tell me, what's been going with Abra? You guys had some really big news the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, we just launched a brand spanking new version of Abra. It uses a first of its kind smart contract platform on Bitcoin and Litecoin to give people investment exposure to up to 20 different cryptocurrencies at the same time, and allows you to hold not only 20 cryptos, but up to 50 fiat currencies, and then exchange between all of them in real time with the one button push kind of user experience. And so it's a pretty big breakthrough for giving retail kind of consumers or retail investors access to cryptocurrencies for the first time.
Now, before, you guys were mainly focused on the money transfer, being sort of a globally accessible transfer business. But now you're doing cryptocurrency custody?
No. So that's part of the breakthrough here, is that there's no third-party custody here in the traditional kind of key management sense. These are multi-sig smart contracts whereby, and it's the same tech that we've been using all along for how we were holding fiat currencies for payments and money transfer. And now we've extended that to be able to use it for crypto. So what that means is the consumer is always holding their own keys, and Abra, as the counterparty to those contracts, is holding its keys, but there's no one-stop shopping for hackers because there's no central custody of funds in our system anymore.
Can I jump in and say something I think is actually really important about what Bill has achieved, guys? And it a little bit harps onto what Dave was saying about the role the blockchain could play in identity. What Abra has achieved is this kind of capacity to treat the blockchain as the settlement layer for the sort of the proof of this data that otherwise resides elsewhere. The custody of the data, the custody of the information, the custody in this case of your coins and your keys, you control. The blockchain is... It is this place in which you can now kind of very smoothly allow for this settlement layer around a contract that is expressed on the blockchain, and that is really, really powerful because but we need to think quite differently about where the data resides and who's controlling it. And then I think actually, if we were to break this down, and it gets rather complex, but if we do, it starts to look a bit like what Dave was talking about in terms of the sort of identity solution that we allude to in the book as well. So Abra's got some very, it's a conceptually different way of thinking about everything. I think that's one of the most
powerful things
about it.
to build on what Mike said, I think what's ultimately important for the crypto community here is that Abra is using Bitcoin, Litecoin, and soon other cryptos as truly programmable money platforms. And I think we're the first company to do that in a consumer-facing model, meaning we're not just treating Bitcoin like another asset class, like digital gold, which we do that as well. But ultimately, it's the programmable money capabilities of the cryptocurrencies that make Abra tick. And ultimately, that's what drives the value of the cryptocurrencies, in our opinion, is their applications as programmable money.
Okay, so on that point, I read an interview from you in Business Insider, about a week ago, Bill, where you said that you see a lot of large institutional money, going into crypto right now because the volatility, this is hedge fund, high net worth individuals, commodity traders, that they see the volatility in the crypto markets as a problem. So, hey, Dave, what's the price of Bitcoin today?
It's about 6,700 at the moment.
US. So, I mean, we're talking about at the peak, the cryptocurrency market as a whole was worth about $800 billion. It's down to about $300 billion today. But obviously, Bill, you're bullish about the future of crypto.
It's part of the same point. Let me go step by step through this, right? So, if you think about what happened in Q4. You had a lot of Japanese institutional investors that were coming in. The government kind of, I'm doing air quotes right now, kind of blessed the space from investors' perspective.
How do you do audio air quotes? You say quote, unquote. That's how you do it.
I'm holding up my hands to make the quotes for those in the audience that were curious. And I think that people, and the culture there kind of lends itself to that being an implicit endorsement of, hey, this is a good thing to do. Whereas in the U.S., we don't really look for government approval. We just basically say, okay, it's allowed until the government tells us it's not allowed. And so I think that what's happening is the number of sellers in the market has not changed dramatically over the past, 7 months, right? People who are long-term hodlers or holders, whatever you want to call them, are still not selling. And so the price in the market is driven by the volume of buyers. And so in Q4, what happened is, or in December in particular, as these institutionals in Japan and Korea came in, it created a bit of a euphoria with retail investors in the US and the UK, which obviously caused the price to spike because folks like Coinbase and others, and even Abra, were getting a lot of retail buyers who were coming in for the first time. But there weren't the volume of large sellers is relatively fixed. So when that euphoria died down, of course, the price started to come back to its previous levels. So that in and of itself was not a surprise to us. But I actually think what's going to drive the price higher long term, and I don't know whether long term is 6 months or 6 years, and to a large degree, I don't really care. But what's ultimately going to drive the price long term is the liquidity requirements for using crypto as programmable money. So what I mean by that is if you're using Bitcoin or Litecoin or Ether-based smart contracts to implement things like Abra, it drives massive demand in the underlying asset class that's being used in that programmable money. And so by definition, if there's millions of people using Bitcoin like TCPIP for money, it's going to drive big demand in cryptocurrency. And in my opinion, only large institutional investment houses are going to be able to deal with the liquidity requirements in that world. So it's complex, but I do think that that's what's ultimately going to drive the price higher. It's that connection between using crypto as programmable money and the liquidity requirements that come with that are going to be met by large institutional investors. And so as they're starting to get that, in the short term, it may be speculative, but long term, I think it's really going to be driven by these liquidity requirements for applications like Abra, which have, in my opinion, significantly sustainable business models.
I was going to say, can I agree and disagree with that, since I am, after all, a consultant?
He used to be indecisive, now he's not so sure.
With the obvious caveat that Bill knows approximately 1 million more times about this than I do. I think I can remember one of the very first conversations I ever had with Michael when I was being very skeptical about Bitcoin I was expounding my crackpot theory that the real innovation is going to come at the app level, which people still keep calling smart contracts, but whatever. This app level, I agree with what Bill said about this. I mean, this is why I'm so
fascinated by the evolution of the world of tokens rather than the evolution of the world of the underlying cryptocurrencies, which I think might change. But I'm not sure about the liquidity argument. And the reason for that is, as the use of the smart ledger applications.
Wow, that's brutal, whoever that was.
Is there like a hurricane or something? What was that?
I have no idea.
That's a Russian satellite sweeping up our conversation. That's what they sound like. So I agree with this point that the applications that sit on top of the shared ledgers are, you know, where the innovation is and what's going on. And, you know, if, as I suspect, a regulated token marketplace becomes actually a very dominant financial marketplace, I'm not sure that necessarily means it drives up the price of the underlying cryptocurrencies. And the reason for that is because the competition to provide those underlying numbers moving around on ledgers, which provide the security that sit underneath those applications, will drive the marginal costs, you know, back down towards zero, essentially. I mean, just like you saw with real money, you had, you know, in England in the 19th century, you know, there was no small change. So you had different people coming into the market to produce copper coins that people needed to pay wages and stuff like that. And the competition drives the marginal cost down to zero. So you end up, in this case, with the government stepping in, nationalizing, providing the cost. So I suspect something similar might happen in the crypto space, in that we think about these applications running on Bitcoin and Ethereum and so on, but actually they're going to be running on some future son of these things, which just aren't going to work. As Michael said earlier on, they're just not going to work in quite the same way. So that's why I agree and disagree simultaneously.
Okay, so Bill, is your response?
Yeah, so there's a lot of nuances in what Dave said. Let me try to break it down. So first of all, the whole point of what you're calling I think you use the term shared ledger or blockchain, which is really one of four key technologies that make Bitcoin and other cryptos work, is to solve the double spend problem. Okay,
that's what is the double spend problem?
The double spend problem says if I'm able to store money on a hard disk, what prevents two people from having the same copy of the money and both spending it? And the whole idea of a blockchain solves that problem. There is no other proven use case for blockchain technology other than that. Okay, so let's put that comment aside for a second. I'm happy to debate that, but I want to make a broader point about what Dave was saying. All right.
Can I just flag that up, Rick? I think you're absolutely right about that, but I want people to understand the magnitude of what you've just said. It's so crucially important, because if you solve the double spend problem, you turn assets into bearer instruments that no longer require a clearing and settlement infrastructure. And that's why you have this lower cost margin in the future.
It's part of my feeling as to why the crypto model is going to ultimately be a decentralized deflationary model and not a traditional inflationary model, and why the price is going to keep going up and to the right, driven by these liquidity requirements, because it's not useful if you can inflate it to infinity the way we inflate fiat currency to infinity. Because by definition, if you're doing that, you're trusting someone. Okay? So the deflationary aspects of the first generation cryptocurrencies is part and parcel to the trustless environment. We can trust the fact that it's going to have not only immutable transactions, but some inherent value because of the way proof of work works, and because of the fact that it's going to approach a certain liquidity level in terms of the float over time. And that is a key component of what gives it its inherent value, and a key component of what makes programmable money work, in my opinion. And so when you actually break, and this is very esoteric and I apologize, but unfortunately it is what it is. When you break this down, there's no other way to do it, in my opinion, right? So I believe that programmable money has to lead to significant liquidity in cryptocurrency markets over time, if it is used for the kind of applications that Dave was alluding to, which is Abra is one example of, and I think Abra is the first really big example of, because the exchanges are not cryptocurrency applications. They're hard lines into the matrix that make cryptocurrency accessible.
Oh, now we're talking about the matrix. I love it.
So my only point is, we haven't even scratched the surface of what programmable money means to the public yet.
I agree with that.
So, hey, Paul, do you want to contribute here? Do you have any thoughts on this?
You guys have gone so deep on me here.
Let's just talk about cryptocurrencies. What do you think is going to happen for crypto for the rest of the year?
Oh my God! If I knew that, you know, I would not be a reporter.
If you had a Bitcoin for every time you're asked that
question. If I had Bitcoin for, yeah, I mean,
warning does not constitute investment advice.
I mean, where do I think it's going? I think it's going to be a smoother year than last year.
Right.
I do. I don't think you're going to have that same kind of mania in trading. And I think you're a year further out in every government and every sort of institution that matters. Say, at least at the point where now they're not at the point now where they're saying, is this something we need to take seriously? They've already taken it seriously, and they're trying to figure out how to work around it and how to figure it out and put rules around it that'll make it safe. Yeah. So I don't think you're going to have the same kind of mania that you saw last year. I think it's going to be a smoother year. Where does that mean in terms of where the prices are going? I mean, I have absolutely no idea. But I do think the thing that will be constant is the rate of innovation. I think you're going to continue to see people experimenting, you know, with cryptocurrencies, with the idea of programmable money, with the idea of new tokens and new services, and with the idea of blockchain overall. So I think while you may not see as much sort of price mania, the innovation, the pace of innovation is not going to stop. So I think that will be constant.
There's one thing I would build on what Paul said that actually could actually increase the rate of innovation, and that's the level of hard forks happening in all of these currencies, right? Because I think that some people in the community were a little frustrated at the rate of change in Bitcoin and Ether and other currencies because of the decentralized governance model, which I actually see as a feature as opposed to a bug. But if you want to actually increase the rate at which things improve, meaning the new features are released and, you know, like things, issues like this whole blockchain scalability issue, it turns out the best way to deal with that is more competition in the market, more cryptocurrencies, more tech, and letting the best tech flow to the top. So I do agree with Dave insofar that, you know, what we may end up using is a cousin of Bitcoin 15 years from now, but that doesn't really matter because hopefully in the crypto land, the best tech will win. And I do think that you're going to see more of these hard forks over the next couple of years. Most of them will die, and that's perfectly fine. But some of them will actually represent real tech innovation, which hopefully will move the space forward at a faster rate.
All right, so listen, we've only got a few minutes left, guys, but Michael?
Brett, we can hear you.
Okay. You want to jump in?
I've just had some tech problems on this side here, but I just want to quickly make a point about the programmable money digital asset question that was coming up there, and it picks up a little bit on what Bill was saying about double spend problem and the importance of it, because while it doesn't just have to apply to money, if we think about data as a currency, which I really believe it is in this sharing data economy, then proving the non sort of double spending state of data is going to be incredibly powerful. And so when Dave talks about different applications that get built on top of it, in some respects, it's using the same concept of a thorough record keeping device that allows us to have a consensus around the shared truth of these transactions. It's just the transactions are not just what we normally think of as money, but all these other forms of data exchange, and that's where the tokens become really useful. So I think a lot of innovation is going to happen once we sort of recognize data as a currency and apply these kinds of thinking to all of that. So just wanted to throw that in there to show, I think, how we go from, you know, traditional Bitcoin as sort of a take on traditional money to something that's sort of bigger than that.
Can I just add one more thing to that point about tokens, Michael? When I was at Money 2020 Asia in Singapore a couple of weeks ago, I had the great good fortune to interview on the main stage Jonathan Larson, who's head of corporate venture capital at Ping An. Ping An is a colossal Chinese investment platform, trillions of dollars. And I asked him about tokens because I wanted to see what the mainstream financial world would say. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing but only very slightly, he said, when the token markets are regulated, we're going to tokenize everything. To go back to Bill's point about the costs of trading in bearer instruments compared to traditional instruments. This is not a tech booster like me. This is a finance guy. And he was, you know, very tokens bullish. Are going to be
huge. So I agree with that.
I've actually made the – you guys haven't got it yet, but Bank 4.0, my new book, which comes out, I made the same conclusion or argument. So. Hey, all right, listen, guys, we've only got a few minutes left.
We're all aligned.
Yep. So we've only got a few minutes left to wrap up. So what I want to do is I want to make sure you know, everyone has your contact details. So, Bill, first of all, how do people find you and find out about Abra?
Yeah, so the easiest way is to follow me on Twitter, Bill Barheitz, my name. Go to abra.com or download Abra from the app stores and join the huge community. I'm stunned as to the response we've gotten in the last, like, month. Our download numbers are just through the roof. So apparently, if you're not,
what does that mean? What is down? Can you talk specific numbers?
I don't even know. It literally changes. Like, I've been offline for the last day doing other media work, and so I'm a couple of days out of date. And it literally has been growing in like 5-6% a day in some days.
Wow.
So it's wow, really exciting. Yeah, and this is a down market, right? So process that. And I mean, I think that if we start screaming higher again, it's going to be incredible.
Insane.
So there's interest even in a down market in this stuff.
Very good. Well, listen, check out Abra if you haven't already. Download the app, check it out, and follow Bill. We'll tweet out some more information about that on the Breaking Banks Twitter feed as well. And once again, for those of you that are interested in Michael and Paul's book, go to Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, visit a bookstore, look for The Truth Machine, and you'll be able to find that, or go to audible.com or amazon.com or wherever good books are sold. So it's been great to have you guys on, Paul and Michael. Michael, thank you for joining the show again this week.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us on.
Yep. And Bill, always a pleasure to have you on the show, and thanks for not doing it from an airport today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
and Dave, thanks again for joining us as co-host.
Yeah, thank you. That was a genuinely interesting discussion, Brett. Thanks for letting me be part of it.
No, fantastic. And so listen, guys, if you enjoyed the discussion today, make sure you share the show. Get online, share it with your friends, tell them to listen to Breaking Banks. And if you get an opportunity, if you go to iTunes or wherever it is you download or listen to the show, and give us a 5-star review, that helps us out, helps people find Breaking Banks out there. So that's important. But thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week. We have an interview with Brock Pierce of the John Oliver fame. Michael Casey, of course, is also a John Oliver fame person. So be sure to join us next week for more of our Blockchain Month. You've been listening to Brett King, Dave Birch hosting Breaking Banks. Thanks again, guys.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.